There are many kinds of museums. From the supersized Smithsonian to the childhood home of Muhammad Ali, from Bangkok to Boston, and everywhere in between. But museum goers only see part of the full picture. On this show, we open the crates, tell the stories, meet the people, and reveal the inner workings, unseen, unheard, until now. From Philbrook Museum of Art and Public Radio Tulsa, I'm your host, Jeff Martin, and this is Museum Confidential. Most museums are built to be museums, but sometimes a space can become a museum completely unintentionally. This takes the perfect mix of history, people, luck, notoriety, and of course, art. One of the best examples of this rare occurrence is the legendary Chelsea Hotel in New York City. Fiona Davis writes novels about famous New York buildings. Actually, it would be more accurate to say that she writes novels about the people who inhabit these buildings. In her most recent release, The Chelsea Girls, Davis allows us to check in and check it out. I guess I'd like to begin by asking, what is the Chelsea Hotel? I think a lot of people have heard about it, whether they're listening to a Leonard Cohen song or watching a documentary or something like that. But it's become lore and legend. How would you describe it and kind of where it stands in the American popular culture?
Yeah, I like to call it a hotbed of artistic and political intrigue that's been around for over a century. It's just incredible, the many musicians and artists and painters and playwrights and fashion designers. There have been so many people who've lived there over the years, like Dylan Thomas, Bob Dylan, Leonard Cohen, Sid Vicious, Arthur Miller. And so people from all different walks of life. And there's something about it that it's this crazy mixing pot of artistic energy. And it's never been a fancy hotel. It's not like the Plaza or the Waldorf Astoria. It's more of this kind of gritty, slightly dark residence for people who come to New York really searching for an artistic home.
Do you think that it represents something of a New York that people still think about but doesn't exist anymore? Meaning the place where as a young struggling artist you could go and survive, with the expectation that, as you said, it wouldn't be glamorous necessarily in the traditional sense, meaning, fancy linens and butlers and things like that. But you would be rich in culture. But in terms of the way New York is now and the way that kind of priced out nature of things has happened, that you really can't do that, but the idea remains?
That's such a good question. The thing about New York City is it's transformed itself every 20 years, ever since it was, first founded. And so the Chelsea Hotel, back in the early part of the 20th century, was considered to be in the theater district. There were a lot of theaters around there. It was full of actors. It had a slightly glamorous feel to it. And even when it was first built, it was built as a cooperative where the idea that plumbers and musicians and painters and electricians would all live in this cooperative utopia. That didn't work. It went bankrupt. And then it became this, the center of Broadway. And then, over time, it's attracted people because it had very low rent. Sometimes the owner would take paintings instead of rent if you couldn't pay up.
Right.
Which is so great. The lobby was filled with paintings that were given over time. But New York is always in transition. And I think we come to New York and the way it was when we first arrived is the way that it should be in our mind. And we get kind of stuck in this arrested development, if you could call it that, about those glory days. And so, yeah, you know, I think it's hard now for artists to come and be in the city. But at the same time, as you walk down Broadway, there's all these empty storefronts where the big businesses are leaving. And it almost feels like part of New York is starting to revert back to the mom and pop stores that used to be here. And so there's cycles of activity and change. And so it's hard to be an artist here right now. But at the same time, I think it's always changing.
We always are asking ourselves the question of what is a museum, because it changes all the time. And sometimes it's just because something decides to call itself a museum. And there's no real rules. If you decide to open a place and call it the Museum of XYZ, you can do that. And no one's going to keep you from doing that. So a lot of it is very subjective in that way. And I'm always interested in kind of accidental museums. And I think the lobby of the Chelsea Hotel, in many ways, is a museum in its own right. Describe what you see even now when you walk into that space and what people would have seen. You know, you mentioned people trading paintings for rent and things like that. Those paintings would inevitably end up a lot of times in that lobby. These would be paintings by people as famous as, you know, Julian Schnabel and major artists like that. But, you know, describe the vibe of the space.
Yeah, I remember popping my head into it probably about 20 years ago. And it was quirky and intimidating, yet inviting. It wasn't pretty. You know, it had this huge, thick, antique furniture, and then these very modern paintings on the wall. There was one sculpture, kind of like a papier-mâché of a girl on a swing hanging from the ceiling. I'm not sure who that was by. It was really, really odd and not prettified in any way. Now, unfortunately, and here's where we're talking about change, the hotel has been bought and has been under renovation by a corporation now for a number of years. There's 50 of the residents still living there under horrific conditions as they upgrade and renovate. So I was inside during the renovation and the entire lobby's gone. There's nothing there but plaster walls now as they work on it. And the staircase that goes down the middle of the building is still there, but everything else is being redone. And to the point where someone found all the old doors and auctioned them off because you knew who lived where, you know, that Sid Vicious killed Nancy in room 100.
Right. Is there all the art that was in there? Is it just gone forever? Are they planning to rehang it in some more modern, you know, updated fashion? Do you have any sense of where that's going?
It's been very tough to find out what's going on because on top of that, the owners sold it to another set of owners. And so it's been a really clunky, difficult transformation. I think they want to make it into a boutique hotel, which means it'll lose all its grittiness. I worry it will be sanitized. And there's no news as to whether they'll try to recreate it and capture that magic or just do something brand new. It'll be very interesting to see if it succeeds or if it fails.
It's like when a CBGB became a John Varvatos shoe store, you know.
I was just by there the other day. Yeah. There is. But at the same time, there's things going on in other places that are kind of interesting. And, you know, I was just recently, and some things do stay the same. I was just in Red Hook at Sonny's Bar, which is this bar that's straight out of an O'Neill play that still exists on the waterfront of Red Hook. And on that Monday night, there was an amazing jazz singer in there. And you felt like you were just back in time. So New York's interesting that way. And we'll see where the Chelsea Hotel ends up.
So the centerpiece of all of your books, of course, is a notable architectural landmark. We're talking about the Chelsea Hotel now, but we also have Grand Central. We also have the Dakota. We also have the Barbizon Hotel for Women. Was this the plan all along to structure your books around famous buildings, or does it just kind of organically grown into a pattern?
It came organically. I had been a journalist for a long time, And I'd wanted to write an article about the Barbizon Hotel and how it's changed over time and how some of the residents have been there for many years, much like at the Chelsea, and how they've seen it go from hotel to condo and what that's like for them when they've been moved into rent-controlled apartments on the fourth floor while, you know, the penthouse goes for $17 million. I just thought it would be an interesting article, but the women there are very private. Who've lived there a long time. But I couldn't shake the idea, and I thought, well, maybe I can write a book because then I can do all the research, which I love to do, and then create a story that I, you know, can make things up, but based on the structure of the building and based on the history of the building. And that became my first book, The Dollhouse. And then from there, I was walking on the Upper West Side and passed the Dakota and thought, wow, I wonder what that was like when it was first built. And that drove me to learn all of these amazing facts about how unusual it was when it was built in 1884.
And for those who don't know, that's the building. John Lennon famously was killed outside and lived in the Dakota. Just for people who may not have a reference of what that building is, this is the place that, you know, is Rosemary's Baby is filmed at the Dakota. It has a lot of cultural touchstones over the years. It's a very, very famous residential building. And I think people have thought about it a certain way, in some ways, because of some of the tragic things that have happened there in a kind of infamous kind of way. When you're doing a bit, something like that, are you trying to utilize those preconceived notions of a place and flip them or doing something else?
You know, I think people associate things like John Lennon and Rosemary's Baby with the Dakota. And so for me, I'm looking for the surprises, the things that surprise me. And also I wanted to be very respectful of John Lennon's death. So I set the book in 1985, which is 5 years after he died, but when the Strawberry Fields, which is the memorial across the street, was being created. And also it's also set in 1884 when it first opened. And so it's, you know, for me, I want to show people what the inner workings of the building was like when it was first built and why it was a risk and why it succeeded. And what was it like for a housekeeper working in there and trying to get it ready for opening day? So for me, it's the surprises. Like for the book that takes place at Grand Central Terminal, the masterpiece, in my research, I learned that there was an art school that was co-founded by John Singer Sargent in Grand Central Terminal, that it was there for 20 years and it had 900 students a year. And I thought, well, if that surprises me, it will surprise the reader. And what a great setting for a book.
Yeah, and I have to imagine, you know, think about some of the students that must have come out of that class, you know, some master like Singer Sargent, you know, doing that, and the trickle-down impact it would have had on art for the next, you know, several decades, if not, you know, the next century.
Exactly. You know, you had Arshile Gorky and the faculty there, Helen Dryden, the illustrator. So I was able to create characters inspired by real people who were part of the Grand Central School of Art. And then the other part of the book takes place in the 1970s when Grand Central was under threat of being destroyed. Its architectural landmark status was taken away because they wanted to put a skyscraper on top. And so the book deals with, you know, the masterpiece, not only a piece of artwork that's discovered in the abandoned art school, but Grand Central itself. Is it a work of art that should be saved, or is it old and should it be destroyed to create something new?
So the Chelsea Girls is a name that I'm familiar with in popular culture because of Andy Warhol's film of the same name. And that's kind of been used a few different times. Did you choose to do that again to kind of have a kind of another lineage of the way that that's been done? Of course, your book takes place kind of in the Red Scare era, 10 years even before Warhol was really big on the scene. But there does seem to be this kind of connective tissue between all these different things. You know, how did you go about kind of laying the groundwork for this book?
Yeah, you know, the name of the book, I'm terrible at names, and so my agent and my editor tend to get together and come up with them. And when they said the Chelsea Girls, part of me thought, oh no, you know, we have to be careful. But again, like you said, it was incorporating all the art that's gone through that building and come out the other side. Yet its own book because it is set during the McCarthy era. And the idea for that book came from interviewing an actress who was born in 1909 and who had lived through the blacklist in New York as a theater actress, and describes to me in the most vivid terms about how awful it was and how it really decimated the acting community. I'd known about the Hollywood 10 and everything that went on in the film industry. This whole idea of a more of a gray list here in New York,
right,
around Broadway and TV and radio, really struck me as something that needed to be told and might be a good story to tell today.
The one thing that's great, of course, is these spaces still exist. They have changed, of course. You know, you mentioned the Chelsea going under major renovations, but you've been there for a while and probably had, you know, you've visited these places before over time. So you have this chance to go into the space. How much access have you had in all the different buildings and books to kind of get to sit down with people that either worked there, lived there, had, you know, direct contact with it? Are you taking those journalist skills that you've had for your entire career and bringing those to bear in a fictional form?
Yeah, you bet. I mean, that's part of the fun for me, is doing that kind of research and getting out of my apartment and my office and going out and interviewing people. So, you know, for the Barbizon book, I was able to find, even with social media, you can find people who were guests at the Barbizon Hotel for Women in the 60s and 70s and ask them what it was like and interview them. And then for the Chelsea Girls, interviewing people like the acting teacher Michael Howard or the actress Lee Grant about what it was like to be blacklisted and realize your friends were turning on you right at the height of your career. For me, that's half the fun. And I love getting tours of buildings. With the Dakota, I was able to meet a current resident who gave me a huge tour from the basement up to the very top floor where the workers used to live. And so for each book, I tend to do a deep dive. And even if I can't get access at first, as I start interviewing experts about the building or historians, I usually find someone who knows someone and get access that way.
Today's episode of Museum Confidential is sponsored by Hotel Art. When it comes to art, it's all about personal taste, of course. A person can like one thing while another person likes something totally, altogether different. But hotels are for everyone. Hotel Art threads that needle, offering a much-needed piece of decor while offending no one. Bowls of fruit, serene landscapes, fiery orange sunsets, a cabin overlooking a pond, animals at rest, buildings with their windows alight in the evening. Take your pick. We've got them all. Because when it comes to hotel art, if we do our job right, you won't even notice it.
As a journalist, what can you do by telling these stories in a fictional setting that you couldn't do if you just wrote a great nonfiction book about these same places? You know, what actually is the benefit to the reader, and why would you want to do it? Obviously, you could easily, with the skill set that you have, write a nonfiction account with the research that you've done and probably tell a really good story at the same time. Why take it in the fictional direction?
I think it all stems from, as a kid, I loved exploring old buildings. We would go back to England every few years, where my relatives all are, and we'd explore castles and, you know, grand estates. And I just was dying to know what it was like for a maid back in the Middle Ages or the 1800s. I just wanted so desperately to go back in time and see what that was like. That's always been there for me. I've always loved historical fiction. And so for me, you know, when I read a nonfiction account of these buildings, and there's a number of them out there, and they're incredibly written and so detailed. But for me, it's when characters are kind of fighting against their best interests sometimes, or trying to find an objective that seems impossible, that's when I get emotionally invested. And so for me, creating these books becomes an emotional journey for the reader to take. But one that's peppered with real history and real facts and surprises that you might not realize otherwise. And also for me, to do two different timelines, it's a way of showing how things have changed over time and how they haven't, specifically women's issues or what it was like to be a woman illustrator in the 1920s versus what it's like in the 1970s. And so you can see how far we've come, or not.
Yeah, I mean, it seems ultimately it comes down to the characters, because I've heard it described that, you know, nonfiction can tell you what happened, but fiction can tell you, or show you rather, how it felt and kind of bring those emotions to the forefront,
that.
You know, and make you connect with things in a different way. You know, we can all read facts, of course, but getting inside the mind of a person is something I think that rarely anything can achieve the way a great piece of fiction can.
Yeah, I think so. And this way, you know, I often have real people popping in and out of my storyline, for especially with the Chelsea girls in the later section, which takes place in 1967. If you keep an eye out, you'll recognize some familiar people. But without having to put words in their mouth or change their stories, I can create a fictional character who can come into contact with them. Just as we would all love to, you know, run into Leonard Cohen in the elevator of the Chelsea. So you could live vicariously through these characters who are leading really rich lives.
As we kind of wrap this up, I'm curious, and this may be state secrets as far as what, you know, you're able to share, but has there ever been a consideration of doing a book around, say, the Metropolitan Museum of Art? I mean, you have some amazing museums there in New York that have a million stories to tell. And if you continue going down this route of famous New York institutions and buildings, could you ever see a museum being the centerpiece of a novel?
Absolutely. I think that would be truly incredible. And the Met would be a great, great place to set a book. Of course, you have the Goldfinch already.
Yeah, I've heard of that. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. But I think that would be fantastic. The next book I'm working on is set at the New York Public Library,
Awesome.
Which is, in a way, a museum of itself, with all the rare books and some of the amazing artifacts that they have there. And so that's been an interesting thing to do a deep dive into that. But yeah, you know, you have the Frick Museum, which used to be a residence. There are so many
great spots. Yeah, it's kind of endless choices, you know? Up there. Yeah, for sure.
And I think a museum's definitely on the list.
Can you talk about just what walking into a really powerful building can do to you? Because I think sometimes people who I know who are really interested in architecture are very evangelical about it, you know, and they're very passionate about it. And then I meet plenty of people who think this is just a square box with, you know, windows and doors, and they don't kind of get the magic of what a space can do at its best. When you walk into a space that really blows you away, what do you feel?
Oh, you know, it's that quote by Goethe that architecture is frozen music.
Yeah.
That always runs through my mind as I'm working on these books, because each building is a journey. And so with the Dakota, you walk into these small, narrow hallways, which are very compressed with very high ceilings. And then you open up into an expansive salon overlooking Central Park, which with windows that are the size of a car. I mean, it's just such an amazing journey to go through from dark to light. And the same with Grand Central, where you come up from the subway and then suddenly you're in the main concourse, where it really feels like you're in the middle of an orchestra, just a silent one as people are running around you. And the idea that they thought ahead of what the space would feel like for you inside, to me, architects are just true heroes. Every day I walk around New York thanking them for the gifts that they've given the city.
There's a small hotel with a wishing well. I wish that we were there together. There's a bridal suite, one room bright and neat, complete for us to share. Together, looking through the window. Thank you.
It's summer 2012. FBI agents arrest two people at the Miami Beach Lowe's Hotel in South Florida. The two people are attempting to sell a stolen 1925 Matisse painting. Valued at $3 million, they're asking a mere $740,000. Originally stolen from a museum in Caracas, Venezuela, the theft remained unnoticed for a time due to the fact that it was not merely stolen but replaced with a forgery. The exact date of the original theft remains unknown. It's assumed to have taken place sometime between 1999 and 2001. The two thieves apprehended in the hotel were later convicted, but no one was ever brought to justice for the original theft. That's our show for this week. Museum Confidential is produced and edited by Scott Gregory at the studios of Public Radio Tulsa. To learn more about what's going on at the museum and at the station, visit philbrook.org or publicradiotulsa.org, or both. We suggest both. Until next time, look closer.